Pope Francis releases a new autobiography called Hope, and it is causing waves. And the new Archbishop of Washington, D.C. is appointed on the eve of President Trump's inauguration. Is Pope Francis trying to send the president-elect a message? The Papal Posse, Father Gerald Murray and Robert Royal, are here with can't-miss analysis. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau recently resigned, and is Greenland about to become an American territory? Canadian author, publisher, and historian Conrad Black shares his thoughts. Tensions between China and Taiwan are on the rise after communication cables to the island nation were mysteriously damaged. Is China's military putting the squeeze on Taiwan? China expert, president of the Population Research Institute, Stephen Mosier, weighs in. The world over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. We have an important show for you tonight. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo or at Real Raymond Arroyo on Instagram. Lots of cool content there for you. First, I want to encourage everyone to pray for all those suffering through those horrible fires in Los Angeles. A landmass the size of two Manhattans has burned. So many friends have lost homes, feel so abandoned, their communities are gone. There are bright spots. A firefighter recovered a tabernacle intact from a burned-out Catholic church, Corpus Christi Catholic Church in Pacific Palisades, of all places. And these tragedies do bring people together. So keep them all in your prayers, and we hope they recover and at least create new homes soon. Pope Francis's new autobiography hit stores this week, and it's already making headlines. At the top of the new year, Pope Francis made a surprise and to many a shocking appointment when he named San Diego Cardinal Robert McElroy as the next Archbishop of Washington, D.C. McElroy is an avowed progressive in the church. And how will McElroy's appointment interact with the second Trump administration? Here with analysis of all this and more, the Papal Posse, editor-in-chief of thecatholicthing.org, Robert Royal, and canon lawyer and priest of the Archdiocese of New York, Father Gerald Murray. Gents, thank you both for being here. Happy New Year. Speaking of new, Pope Francis's latest book, Hope, the autobiography, hit stores this week. It's the first autobiography ever published by a reigning pontiff and was intended to be released after his death. But according to the press release, quote, the needs of our times and the 2025 Jubilee Year of Hope convinced Francis to release it now. Taking 6 years to write, he touches on his life as Jose Maria Bergoglio, his Italian roots, his priesthood and pontificate so far. Gents, I want to take a look at a couple of the subjects that Pope Francis covers in Hope. He has this to say about traditional Catholics and the Latin Mass. Here's the quote. It is interesting to consider the phenomenon of traditionalism, this backwardism that regularly returns each century, this reference to a supposed perfect age that each time is another age. With the liturgy, for example, it has now been ruled that the possibility of celebrating Mass in Latin following the Missal prior to the Second Vatican Council must be expressly authorized by the Dicastery for Divine Worship, who will allow it only in certain cases. For this reason, that is unhealthy for the liturgy to become an ideology. It is curious to see this fascination for what is not understood, for what appears somewhat hidden, and seems also at times to interest the younger generations. This rigidity is often accompanied by elegant and costly tailoring, lace, fancy trimmings, rochets, not a taste for tradition, but clerical ostentation, which then is none other than an ecclesial version of individualism, end quote. Sorry for that long quote, but I wanted to give you context. Father, this has become a favorite subject of Pope Francis and his confreres, traditionalism and the rigidity that created it or perhaps spawned it. Where is the dialogue, the synodality that the Pope often speaks of?
No, this is very regrettable that the Pope continues to preach this line that the people who like the Latin Mass are psychologically disturbed, nostalgics, they're unable to live in the present, they try to live in an imaginary past, according to him. Yet he admits that these are young people going to it, therefore, they don't have any remembrance of that past that allegedly they're pining for. What I find most disturbing is that the Pope is issuing a judgment and characterization of a whole group of people that he has made no effort to meet with, to listen to walk with, to accompany. You know, I noticed that the Pope has called meetings with ecological advocates, with people who are in favor of, you know, economic solutions that are more in keeping with human dignity, according to, you know, the pretensions that are given on that. Basically, socialism is being promoted. What about a meeting with the hundreds of thousands of Catholics throughout the world who love to go to the old Mass, who want to pray, want to raise their children in dignity and having lots of experiences of prayer in a mysterious kind of situation where the Mass is glorifying God and not simply a meeting of the people? So I'm very upset when I hear this, because this I know people who go to the Latin Mass. I celebrate the Latin Mass. This is not what this is all about.
No. Bob, I happened to go to a Latin Mass this week. It was the traditional feast day of Our Lady of Prompt Succor, who's the patroness of New Orleans. And it was, you could hear a pin drop, but it was, you could feel the souls of everyone sort of united in offering worship to God in a way that, because of the rigor of it and the silences built in and the gorgeous music, it allows you to pray through all of that and with all the people around you. But the Pope has coined a new term for this. He calls it backwardism. Is that what the tradition is and what about 2,000 years of patrimony of the Church and liturgy is? I mean, if this is all backwardism, shouldn't we just toss everything out? Forget it. Let's just have a Pachamama guitar mass.
Yeah, like both of you, I know lots of people who attend the Latin Mass, and the way he describes them certainly doesn't correspond with what I know about them. I mean, you can always find a few neurotic people who are sort of clinging to something in the past. But in his autobiography that just came out, the one you mentioned, Raymond, it's interesting that he says a couple of things that really contradict what he's saying here about the Latin Mass. For example, I wrote this down. He says, he spoke to indigenous people. He says this very early on in the autobiography. He says, please don't abandon the legacy of your grandparents or your ancestors. Well, what are they going to cling to but, you know, the previous ways that they celebrated their worship or, you know, the cultural things that they held in common? And, you know, you hold on to that because there's a real wisdom that he recognizes in other people's past. But he doesn't seem to recognize it in the past of the Church. It's interesting, at another point later in the autobiography, he says, I think just before that long quotation that you read, that an American cardinal came to him and said the two priests asked if they could say the Latin Mass. And he said, well, can you speak Latin? They said, no, we'll learn. And he said, well, wait a minute. If you're going to learn, first learn how many the Vietnamese language and see how many Vietnamese are in your parish, and first learn Spanish because you have lots of Spanish speakers in your parish. And there's nothing wrong with that, of course. But are we supposed to cater to particular contemporary language groups, but our own universal language of the Church is somehow off limits? I find this very, very disturbing.
Yeah, the traditional liturgy gives you the silver bullet. That is the language of the Church, and everybody can take part. Vietnamese, Spanish, French, which is what I saw the other day at this Latin Mass I attended. There were international speakers there. They did not share a common vernacular, but everybody took part in the Mass, and it was glorious.
Yeah, the thing I was just going to say about this is it's curious that this came from the United States in particular. And, you know, why one person's voice should outweigh hundreds of thousands of people who find some comfort and inspiration and contact with God in this form of the Mass, I don't understand that. And I think it goes back to something we've talked a lot about in this show, and that is that there's a division. The Pope talks often about not allowing the Church to become a prey to ideologies. But in a funny way, he seems to have because of his own experience, and there's a lot about his own experience in the 60s and 70s in the autobiography, I think because of his own experience and maybe his own rigidity in the past, that he feels obliged to kind of denounce something that he feels himself was a distortion of his own spirituality.
Father, there's no doubt young people are drawn to this old mass, to the traditional mass. I shouldn't call it that. It's the ancient mass of the church and the eternal mass of the church. Distinguish, if you will, because I know a lot of people are tuning in. They say, well, look, the Pope is saying this old mass is a rigid thing. How young people are rigid, I don't understand. But OK, let's just take him on face value. Distinguish, if you will, quickly between papal musings in a personal bit of memoir and doctrine.
Yeah, well, of course, the Pope has an opinion about how things should be in the world and in the church, but those opinions have to be based on fact. And what I find troubling here is that the Pope is assuming and asserting that people like the old mass are psychologically unbalanced and that they are, in the case of priests, that they're power-hungry clericalists who want to dominate the lay people. Making those assumptions allows him never to address the issue of why the Latin Mass has value. In other words, it's theological, mystical, and spiritual value. You can simply say, these are a bunch of people who are, you know, unbalanced. I don't talk to unbalanced people. I pray for them, send them to a doctor, but we're not going to give them what they focus on. So, you know, papal intuitions about how other people behave have to be fact-checked, so to speak. You have to meet with those people. Yeah. That's what really bothers me here. Why isn't there a Congress in Rome where the Pope could hear from Latin Mass goers and priests and bishops who like the Latin Mass and explain why they like it? I think that would be a real example of synodality that we're told is now the new way of doing things in the church.
Right. Cardinal Blaise Supich recently criticized the custom of kneeling for communion in Chicago, stopping short of forbidding it, but he did criticize it. Other bishops have also discouraged the practice. Why such antipathy to respect for the Blessed Sacrament? And do they see the discordance, and I'll start with Father on this, between spending millions of dollars on a Eucharistic revival while depressing respect for the Eucharist in their own dioceses?
Well, who knows the real reason for what the Cardinal had just said? All I can do is, from what I see, is when people who don't like the kneeling at the Mass, they basically say, we change from kneeling to standing. Change is good. The past has to be banished. This falls in with this idea that you can't look to the past to gain knowledge of how to act in the present and the future. So it is hostile to people's piety to tell them you can't kneel to receive Holy Communion. And where is the respect for the spiritual good of the faithful? I mean, I love receiving communion kneeling. I'm a priest now, so I distribute communion. But I think it's very reverent. It's the way I learned as a kid. There's no reason to stop it, saying, well, people are going to trip over people in the aisle. How about a little respect and patience? You know, we're not online at Needix to get hot dogs. You know, we got to be respectful. So we'll leave it at that.
Bob, there is news today that Pope Francis fell and injured his arm. This follows a fall a few weeks ago where the Pope bruised his chin. Age seems to be taking a toll, which I suppose is perhaps why this biography is dropping now. Or is it? What does this episode tell us?
Well, he certainly seems to be, he goes up and down in health, and he certainly seems to be in a kind of a down mode right now. I mean, to fall twice within a matter a few weeks for an 88-year-old who's already in a wheelchair, and he looks very bloated at this point. But look, we've seen this happen in the past, and he's recovered, and you know, we can only pray that his health gets better, and you know, he's able to continue doing what's good he can do for the church. The you know, the overall sense that you get from the publication of the book, though, is not that this is some kind of tie to either his current health or something else. I think that what the consideration was is you get this out early in the Jubilee year, and somehow you use this to set an agenda. There's a lot of talk about hope toward the end of the book. I think it goes on a little bit too long, but it's a good message to send out there. But what the internal reasons might be, I don't know. We've seen health up and down, and maybe we'll have some surprises in one direction or another.
Yeah. Pope Francis also makes sure to address LGBT issues in this autobiography. Here's the quote. More than 60 countries in the world treat homosexuals and transsexuals as criminals. a dozen or so with the death penalty, which is sometimes even carried out. But homosexuality is not a crime. It is a human fact. And the church and the Christians cannot remain indifferent in the face of this criminal injustice, nor can they respond faint-heartedly. They are not children of a lesser God. God the Father loves them with the same unconditional love. He loves them as they are, and he accompanies them in the same way that he does with all of us, being close to us, merciful and tender. If the Lord says everybody, who am I to exclude anybody? Father Jerry, this certainly dovetails with the story this week that a provisional document by the Italian Bishops' Conference opens the door to the ordination of openly homosexual men to the priesthood, so long as they remain celibate. That's been approved by the Vatican. Your reaction to all of this?
Unfortunately, the Pope is spouting propaganda of the homosexual interest groups. What he's referring to as crime is sodomy. Sodomy was outlawed in the entire Christendom for most of history. That was done away with recently in most countries, but in African countries, those laws against sodomy continue. You have no right to commit sodomy. It's an immoral act, and it's socially destructive. The Pope is saying that God loves homosexuals just as they are. Does he mean God loves them committing acts of sodomy? I hope not, because sodomy is a mortal sin. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church teaches that it is an abomination. It's a horrible thing. It should never be done. So the Pope is endorsing the homosexual lifestyle by saying that these people have to be respected, that the Catholic Church should not say anything to disturb the peace and tranquility of people who have embraced the homosexual lifestyle. Just the opposite. We have to preach the truth of Christ and say there is no happiness and salvation in pursuing a life that's dedicated to committing acts of mortal sin. That is not the way you're supposed to live. That's the message of the church. It's always been that message.
Bob, react to this story from the Italian Bishops' Conference of opening up ordinations to avowed homosexual men who say they're celibate now.
Yeah, I think there's been a bit of an overhyping of the change here. It was driven by the Italian secular press, who, like the New York Times, would like us to think that the Vatican is moving in a pro-homosexual direction. The language that's still there is that people who are actively homosexual or have a strong homosexual inclination or who support the gay culture, by which I think they mean activism. I don't think they want to say that outright, but I think that's what, that they cannot be ordained. They should not be put through, be admitted to the seminary and then ordained. I think that that has remained mostly clear there, but there's no doubt that, you know, the way that tails off at the end, those three categories that I just mentioned, then goes on to say that having any of that makes it impossible for the priest to have a proper relationship to men and women. Well, no, the problem is that they're inclined to immoral acts, as Father was saying, and that they're likely not to be a very good example of what the Christian life is. Not that they are going to somehow have some pastoral or human difficulties with other people. It's a problem with God, not with other people.
Okay, I need to move on to another story also from Rome. The Vatican is cracking down on illegal entry into its borders, the Vatican City State. In a decree issued in December, the Pontifical Commission for the Vatican City State toughened its sanctions against those who violate Vatican security, with prison sentences from 1 to 4 years and fines ranging from $10,000 to $25,000. The penalties will apply to anyone who enters secure Vatican spaces by means of violence, threats, deception, bypassing border controls or security systems. Father, this sounds like open borders for thee, but not for we. What happened to not building walls, but building bridges?
Well, you know, reality imposes itself, and the idea that there's a right, every human being has a right to enter any jurisdiction he wants for any reason, and that there's a right not to be thrown out of that jurisdiction, that's proven to be false. Of course, no such right exists. The Holy See, that's a very small territory in Vatican City State, so the Vatican City State authorities now recognize if they got what we would call a bum's rush, let's say 500 or 1,000 immigrants showed up and barged their way into the territory and set up tents and wanted to sleep there, that's precisely what's happening at the U.S. border, by the way. And the Vatican's not going to tolerate it, and neither should the United States. Legal entry in an orderly and legal manner is what we want. And I'm all in favor of legal immigration. It's a great thing. But illegal immigration is not a great thing. It's a violation of law, and it promotes a lawless attitude among the people who are entering the country.
Bob, we'll get to this in the next story, but why do the Vatican and national bishops' conferences go apoplectic when nations attempt to defend and police their own borders, yet the Home Office can issue these kind of strict controls, including jail time?
Yeah, I mean, this is another one of these disconnects that is very hard to understand. I mean, as Father rightly says, the Vatican has just showed us what every sovereign country has the right to do, and that is to declare who can come in, who has to be kept out, what kind of procedures are going to be put in place to do this sort of thing. I get the sense, both from our own bishops and from several figures in the Vatican, that they haven't yet appreciated how seriously this new wave of massive immigration is impacting the world. And they're also, by the way, reacting against the political reaction among the people. They keep on talking about this false populism, by which they mean here in the United States, the election of Trump. There are political parties in Europe that are now their majorities in many European countries that are trying to stop immigration and even reverse it where they can possibly do it. So they're I think they're really stuck in the past with this idea that, and with an over-idealized idea of welcoming the stranger and receiving people from outside. That's all very good. But as Father says, proper immigration is the right way to do this. Allowing people to break the law to come into your country, to enter by doing something that's illegal is not really doing them or your country a favor.
Well, it goes back to what I always say. Ignore what people say. Watch what they do. That will tell you what is really at play and what they really believe. On January 6th, the Vatican announced that Pope Francis has named 70-year-old Cardinal Robert McElroy as the next Archbishop of Washington, D.C., on the eve of President Trump's inauguration. McElroy had this to say at a press conference shortly after his appointment was announced. Watch.
The Catholic Church teaches that a country has the right to control its borders. And our nation's desire to do that is a legitimate effort. At the same time, we are called always to have a sense of the dignity of every human person. And thus, plans which have been talked about at some levels of having a wider, indiscriminate, massive deportation across the country would be something that would be incompatible with Catholic doctrine.
Bob, the U.S. bishops have already spoken about the Trump plan for mass deportations of criminal illegal aliens. Will Cardinal McElroy now be the point man for the USCCB's opposition here?
Well, he's in an odd position. As we know, the appointment to Washington was resisted by, it appears, Cardinal Wuerl, Cardinal Gregory. It looks like Christophe Pierre, the nuncio, also opposed it, and maybe even Pietro Parolin, the Vatican Secretary of State. So it took a while for the Pope to come around to this, and some people are saying it's in response to the appointment of Brian Birch as our ambassador to the Holy See. Look, the American progressives were not able to prevail against President Trump. I don't believe that Cardinal McElroy is going to have much effect either. And for me, the disconnect here is our bishops are not as radical as Cardinal McElroy is. He's very far to the left, I think even farther to the left than the Pope. I've written that I think he would be much more appropriate a bishop for the German Bishops' Conference than he is for the American Bishops' Conference. And putting him in Washington, which is a very sensitive post. Mostly what the Cardinal Archbishop here has to do is to speak quietly, have quiet diplomacy, keep a lid on the both conservatives and liberals and progressives and libertarians and all those other political people who live here in Washington. I live outside of Washington, so I'm very sensitive. And it's also the case that this area is rather traditional in its spirituality and in its liturgy. So it's an odd appointment. I think we'll have to see what happens.
Father, the administration has been quite clear about targeting criminal illegals for deportation. Your thoughts on McElroy's role here, and given how little influence the bishops had over a professed Catholic, Biden, will they have any more influence over Donald Trump?
Well, if the U.S. bishops are opposed, including Cardinal McElroy, to deporting criminal aliens, they're not going to have any support among the Catholic or otherwise population in the United States. The trained Aragua gang is causing havoc in my part of the world, the New York area. They're causing havoc other places. It's quite clear that there's a penetration of gangs and violent drug cartels in the United States, taking advantage of the Biden open border policy that we've had for 4 years. So people aren't ready to say, okay, millions of people entered illegally. I guess the best thing to do is say, stay here, no problem. No, that's not going to wash. We've got to stop what's basically been a promotion of an illegal way of life for foreigners coming into this country. People who don't belong here have no legal right to stay. You can call it mass deportation. It's basically a law enforcement operation. Tell those people, you want to come here? Go home, get back online, try to do it legally. Because illegal entry have no right to be in the country.
Yeah, it's illegal. It's illegal. And the church does not support illegality and breaking the law of a country. It just doesn't. You know, and you can welcome the stranger without throwing your borders open and letting anybody in at any time. Orderly immigration is part of the social teaching of the church. Jens, we should remind EWTN viewers that back in March of 2023, Cardinal McElroy was a bit hostile toward this network when asked about a Spanish bishop who banned EWTN from being broadcast in his diocese. McElroy said he, too, would not have EWTN on diocesan media in San Diego, referring somewhat vaguely to, quote, the main anchors at EWTN who, quote, minimize the abilities and theological knowledge of Francis, end quote. Bob, your thoughts.
Well, I don't know that the cardinal is a very close student of EWTN. I think if he was speaking about us or if he watched us, he would get a more nuanced impression of what it is that we actually say. But, you know, again, one of the ironies here is I'm not going to name the publication, but a progressive so-called Catholic publication has said of him that he is a man of dialogue, but he very much wants to choose who he has dialogues with in person, I suppose, and in his diocese.
Gents, Cardinal McElroy is also on record as being pretty tough on practitioners of Catholic tradition. In 2024, before the Los Angeles Religious Education Conference, he said, how do the doctrinal tradition and history of the church restrict the church's ability to refine its teaching when confronted with a world where life itself is evolving in critical ways? And it is becoming clear that on some issues, the understanding of human nature and moral reality upon which previous declarations of doctrine were made were in fact limited or defective. Father, he went on to comment that the deposit of faith, divine revelation, was often poorly served on some issues by the church's previous doctrinal declarations. You wrote a column about this. What should we remember about this utterance? And especially now that he's the new Cardinal Archbishop of Washington.
Yes, this is a very serious problem. That speech at the Los Angeles Religious Ed Conference, he endorsed the homosexual lifestyle in that by saying, as you just said, that he calls it previous church teaching. No, just church teaching. Let's say it that way. The doctrine of the deposit of faith is poorly served by the church. No, the church enunciates the deposit of faith. Human science giving us new advances in evolution on moral teaching? Wrong answer. The teaching of the Catholic Church that sodomy is inherently immoral cannot change. It's biblical and natural law truth. No, Cardinal McElroy is a critic of the Church's teaching on the inherent immorality of homosexual activity, and that is a very big concern. People who have problems with homosexual attraction do not need to be told by a cardinal of the church that your lifestyle's okay and we're going to change the church's teaching. No, they need to hear the truth of Christ. That's liberating. That's where the peace and joy of Christ come in. Embrace his teaching.
Bob, McElroy is also a fierce advocate for a female diaconate. How do you see that playing in D.C.? And are Catholics paying enough attention to any of this?
Well, if you mean by Catholics, the general population in the United States, Catholic population, I don't think many people have yet taken the measure of this. Yeah, I wrote it myself that there on a number of issues, because of the way that the priests and the parishes are kind of structured and they're run here in Washington, I don't think it's going to play very well with his own presbyterate. If he begins to talk about, he's talked about not making a distinction between people who are active homosexuals and people who are same-sex attracted, as if that's not, he says it's not the starting point to consider this. Well, I don't know what other starting point you can have if you're going to try to decide, you know, what can be allowed inside the church and what cannot be allowed inside the church. So I think he's going to come against some resistance among his own priests on that issue. And there are a whole bunch of other things like that, like the female diaconate, which probably will play pretty well with certain political figures in Washington, but I think in the church in Washington, it's not going to be a winner.
I want to move on, and look, there's so much to consider here, and we will get in the weeks ahead to Cardinal McElroy and his handling of the sex abuse charges against Cardinal McCarrick. He was involved in that, warned ahead of time. There's also charges that he mishandled sex abuse cases in his own diocese, but there's time for that in the days ahead. Pope Francis has named an Italian nun, Sister Simona Brambilla. She's the prefect of the Vatican Dicastery in charge of religious orders. Now, Sister Brambilla is the first woman to head a major Vatican Dicastery. Father, what are the canonical implications of having a woman lead a dicastery? This is, of course, being celebrated in the media. Weren't prefects of congregations, now known as dicasteries, supposed to be able to celebrate Mass? I mean, they have a cardinal who's the pro-prefect along with her. Does that mean they share the prefecture?
Well, the problem is not appointing a woman. The problem is appointing a layperson, i.e. a non-ordained person. Now, she's a religious sister. She's a layperson who's made vows in a religious order. But this is a problem. The sheep cannot serve as shepherds. The Catholic Church is not a human organization. It was created by Christ, founded on the apostles, and he called the apostles the shepherds. Pasture my sheep, he told them. The shepherds of the church exercise the governance, and you cannot be exercising governance if you don't have the capability of exercising it by virtue of being ordained. Now, this, of course, is taught by Vatican II. It's in the Code of Canon Law. It's very disturbing that the Pope takes an act which contradicts one of the canons in the Code of Canon Law. If he's going to change it, he's got to change the code first. And having a pro-prefect, meaning a second prefect, only creates further confusion. You know, who's in charge here? What is the meaning of having two heads of a congregate, or now it's called a dicastery? So this is very disturbing, and it's a politicization of the Roman Curia. Mm. We're scoring points by telling feminist lobbyists, don't worry, women of power. This is the same problem that happened when somebody asked, what about women at the synod with an equal vote? And the Pope said, sure, let's do it. Well, that just changed. That basically destroyed the synod of bishops as an institution of bishops. So this is not a good thing, and the Pope's disregard of canon law, just saying, well, I'll do this even though it contradicts the canon law, then what else in canon law is going to be set aside? It creates so much uncertainty that the canonical system basically becomes, what does the Pope say tomorrow? That's not how you run a system of law.
Bob, you know, it's curious. You watch these DEI heads and universities, major businesses. The diversity and equity offices are being shuttered, dismantled. But count on church and these parachurch groups to embrace it, just as everyone else is rejecting it and realize this was a big mistake. But pastorally, is this the best person for this post to run a congregation?
Yeah, that's a good question. And actually, I looked into her background and what she had to say. I mean, she's impressive in that she's had a number of posts. She's got a PhD from somewhere on, I think, on religious life. And she's very, but the other side of her is she's very much a part of the synodality movement. She really has touted that. She's talked about, and this is a phrase that I hear a lot of people who are committed to synodality using. They talk about, we're not going back. When I see that, I say to myself, we're not going back to what? And then he said, you know, we're talking with one another now. Well, we never talked to one another before. Or, we're, you know, we're we're merciful now. Well, we were never merciful before. You know, we never focused on Christ before. There's a funny, I can remember the 70s. There's a kind of a funny 70s
yes.
vibe to this.
Vibe.
We've kind of moved yeah. into something new, and you know, we've cast off the dead skin of the past, and that worries me almost more than anything. I think that the jurisdictional thing is going to have to resolve itself somehow, but this idea yeah. that she's kind of going to be there to promote synodality in this, you know, new and improved mode, that worries me a great deal. I've got to say.
Yeah, this is like Vatican II, too. You know, it's the sequel to Vatican II. Look, there was a story that's gotten little attention. I want to end with this. French Bishop Dominique Ray announced his resignation last week at the request of Pope Francis. And this got very little coverage outside of some church channels. And it ends a controversial chapter in the history of his French diocese, which has endured two apostolic visitations over 3 years. His crime? Too many vocations, apparently. His diocese is booming in vocations to the priesthood. The bishop had this to say: I am mainly criticized for welcoming too broadly priestly and religious communities or vocations, in particular from the traditional world. Father, once again, we seem to be witnessing an assault on traditional Catholicism that is working in the church when everything else is failing. Why attack the faithful that are clearly clamoring for respect and dignity of the sacraments and faith lived large and loudly in an Orthodox way?
Well, walking together is only for those who are invited to join the pack, and he was definitely a maverick. He had more seminarians than any other diocese in France, with the exception of Paris. He was definitely a man. He was from the charismatic renewal. He appreciated traditions. He was out of step with the spirituality of many of his confreres in the French hierarchy. And it's very upsetting that the Pope asked him to resign. What about brotherly bishop respect? You know, this is not how it's supposed to work. He didn't commit any canonical crimes. And if you disagree with his judgments, well, the Pope doesn't agree with every other bishop in the world. He doesn't fire them or ask them to resign. So this is very, very troubling. The French church has enough problems as it is. Now one of the most successful bishops of reinvigorating the faith has been cast aside. I'm really sorrowful for this. I pray for the church in France.
Bob, your reaction to this forced resignation of a successful bishop doing what he's supposed to be doing?
Yeah, again, I would say that this is something that is puzzling, and it's this confusion or even contradiction within the mind of the Pope, because he spends a lot of time in his autobiography, Hope, talking about how unity does not have to be uniformity. And I think that's correct, that the Catholic Church is a worldwide operation. It can have all sorts of different rites. It can have different expressions, different religious orders. But it seems to that the non-uniformity only seems to point in a kind of a progressive or if you want, liberal direction. It cannot point back to a different form of a more traditional liturgy. It seems to attract both people and vocations. I would pay attention. Yeah. If I would pay attention.
Yeah, this is eternal. This worship is eternal. And, you know, I think it's going to outlast the felt banners and the guitar mash. Just a guess. Posse, we will leave it there for now. For commentary by Robert Royal and Father Gerald Murray, visit thecatholicthing.org. Thank you both. The embattled Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has resigned. When will there be an election to replace him? And what will the future of the U.S.-Canadian relationship look like under new leadership? For answers, we turn to historian, publisher, and columnist, best known in his native Canada as the founder of the National Post newspaper and Hollinger International. Welcome back to the program, Lord Conrad Black. Conrad, thank you for being here. Before we get to Canada, I want to get your international perspective on some news that broke this week. Both President Joe Biden and President-elect Donald Trump are taking credit for this ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in Gaza on Wednesday. The deal frees 33 Israeli hostages, puts on hold the war that's raged for 15 months. Trump says the deal is a result of his win in November. Biden says the terms of the deal are what he already proposed in the spring. Who's right, Conrad?
Well, I think technically they're both right, but Undoubtedly, President Biden did make that proposal in the spring, but nothing was done about it until President Trump was elected. And so producing the conditions was Biden's doing, but that didn't require, with respect, a great deal of imagination. But getting it done, and getting it done now, is, as everyone, as far as I can see, the Times of Israel, the State Department spokesman, have acknowledged this was Trump's doing. And it reminds everybody of the inauguration of Ronald Reagan and the hostages in Tehran. They were boarding the Algerian plane as the President Reagan was giving his inaugural address. The proposal was out there starting in May, but the thing that got it done, the catalyst, obviously, is the president's election and his statement that there'd be hell to pay if the hostages were still in custody when he was inaugurated.
Yeah, and even Netanyahu came out and said it was Trump's pressure that, you know, sort of got him to the bargaining table. Conrad, on January 6th, the resignation of embattled Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau made headlines all over the world. I want to play this for you, get your reaction.
I intend to resign as party leader, as prime minister, after the party selects its next leader through a robust, nationwide, competitive process. Last night, I asked the president of the Liberal Party to begin that process. This country deserves a real choice in the next election, and it has become clear to me that if I'm having to fight internal battles, I cannot be the best option in that election.
Conrad, why is Trudeau making this decision now? I mean, he's been under fire for a long time.
It's got steadily worse, though, Raymond. His position in the polls are fairly similar to President Biden's. He's trailing the leader of the official opposition, by more than 20 points. And that's a very rare thing in this country. It's not completely unprecedented, but rare. And he's had, as you know, it's a different system here. You have to maintain the support of your members of parliament, and right. They're rippling discontent all around that caucus, and a number of them, it's a minority government to begin with, and the leaders of the unofficial opposition parties have said they won't support him in a confidence vote. And in addition to that, a significant number, maybe almost half of his own party members in parliament, have said to him that he has to go, and about a quarter of them have said it publicly. So his position was really unsustainable, and he did the right thing. If I may say it, he at least did it less tardily than President Biden did the comparable thing in your country. I mean, they do have the opportunity to have a properly organized convention and choose the person that party believes to be the best one to succeed him. Now, well, that said, in this country, as again most serious democracies, you don't normally get the same party in office for more than 10 years.
As you alluded to, the Canadian parliamentary system differs greatly from what we're used to in the United States. The prime minister does not have a set term. He or she has to call an election. And now the parliament's been suspended up until March 24th. So what happens then? And how will that candidate be chosen?
There is, by the way, considerable doubt about the legality of the prorogation of parliament for almost 3 months, just to accommodate the convenient Liberal Party. But because it's leading to an election, nobody is really doing much. You know, time is passing, and we can all wait till March 25. But at that point, the Liberal Party will have chosen a new leader. Justin Trudeau will go to the chief of state, whose title is Governor General, and tender is ready with the recommendation that the new Liberal leader be called upon to form a government. But it is, pardon me, agreed by all of the opposition parties that they will demand an immediate election. And so the period of the election is somewhat flexible, but it would probably be approximately 6 weeks after that, so in the middle of May.
Conrad, we have a new administration, as you know, about to take the reins of power here in the United States. The president-elect has made waves of late by referring to your country as a potential 51st state and threatening 25% tariffs against Canada. What do you make of this strategy? Is this just Trumpian grandstanding, or is there something else going on here?
I wouldn't call it grandstanding, but it's, it's poker playing by the author of The Art of the Deal. And you know, he's exaggerating. if Justin actually said to him at Mar-a-Lago, if you do that, you'll completely destroy our country, then Justin should have been thrown at the window of the official residence. I mean, it wouldn't. It would be a terrible inconvenience. But Canada is a G7 country. We have a larger GDP right. than Russia. I mean, it is not a you know, it's not like annexing El Salvador or Puerto Rico or something. And so, it was rather cavalier of the president to refer to it that way. But he, you know, he's a very amusing man, and it was a good joke. And we should. And most people in Canada don't take it personally. They think it's, you know, Donald Trump being humorous and a bit hyperbolic, you know.
Okay, but speaking of annexing, the president has also floated the possibility of annexing Greenland, okay, which has set the Danes' teeth to chatter. Now, there's a 1951 treaty, Lord Black, the Greenland Defense Agreement, that allows the United States to keep military bases in Greenland and to establish new bases there, if necessary, by NATO. Here is what Trump said recently about Greenland. I want your reaction.
We need Greenland for national security purposes. I've been told that for a long time, long before I even ran. I mean, people have been talking about it for a long time. You have approximately 45,000 people there. People really don't even know if Denmark has any legal right to it. But if they do, they should give it up because we need it for national security. That's for the free world. I'm talking about protecting the free world.
Conrad, what is Trump's strategy here? And is there a way for the U.S. to purchase or somehow negotiate ownership of Greenland?
Well, you know, the actual population of Greenland is closely related to the population in northern Canada and the corresponding part of Arctic Canada. And there have been some discussions between Canada and Greenland, too. But I think, as a matter of fact, we have to get serious, we, the Canadians and Americans, about defending the Arctic from the Russians and the Chinese. I mean, you know, it's the ocean, and we're the four powers that Chinese are muscling in from outside. But the United States, Canada, and Russia have the coastline there. And we have to assert ourselves. In this case, the U.S. and Canada should act together. As I understand it, Greenland is a great cost burden to Denmark, which is a wonderful country, but it's a country of only 5 million people. I mean, half the population of metropolitan Toronto, in which I'm sitting now. And it's a great burden to it. So I would have thought something could be done. And if need be, I think if you had a referendum of the approximately, 45,000 people in Greenland, yeah, adult citizens, and you made it quite a sweet offer, I think they'd take it. Now, I think, by the way, it would be stronger if we took it together, Canada and the U.S., but in any case, Canada should pull its weight. It should stop being a slacker and a foot dragger in NATO. Pay its way. And we should work closely with the United States to defend the Western interest in the Arctic. And that means Greenland. And Denmark isn't a large or rich enough country to do that.
Yeah. Lord Conrad Black, always wonderful talking to you. We will leave it there. Thanks you for being here and Happy New Year. We'll see you soon.
Right, sure. Thank you, Raymond. Good to speak with you again.
North Korea launches multiple short-range missiles in the direction of Japan. And reports surfaced that vital communication cables connecting Taiwan to mainland China were recently damaged or perhaps intentionally cut. Taiwan is investigating whether a ship linked to communist China may be responsible. Here with analysis of these stories and more, the president of the Population Research Institute, author of The Devil and Communist China, Stephen Mosier. Steve, thanks for being here. I want to start with North Korea. The rogue nation launched a number of ballistic missiles from the interior of the country into waters between the Korean Peninsula and Japan. This is the second such launch in this brand new year. What is the intention of North Korea, particularly in these days leading up to the inauguration of a new administration here in Washington?
Well, I think North Korea is having its strings once again, puppet strings once again, pulled by China. China, you know, North Korea wouldn't even have missiles if it hadn't been given the missile technology by China. And this is China sending indirectly a message to Donald Trump that he'd better pay attention to the Korean Peninsula. You see, that's where the crisis is. And avert your eyes from Taiwan, which is where Taiwan, of course, is in danger of being taken over by communist China at any moment. And I think that Beijing would like to see Trump focus on Korea rather than Taiwan.
Stephen, recently Taiwan's Coast Guard dispatched a vessel to that site of the severed undersea cable, which is, has the vital communications, and they discovered a Hong Kong-owned cargo ship about 7 nautical miles away. What should we make of this, given China's increased activity in that whole South China Sea region?
Well, here's what's going on. China is trying to cut off Taiwan's ability to communicate with the rest of the world. And this is not the first time this happened, Raymond. Last year, there are offshore islands, including Matsu and Quemoy, that Taiwan also controls. And last year, a Chinese ship severed the cables connecting communications cables, undersea cables, connecting Matsu to the mainland and to Taiwan. So they've done this gambit before. And I believe that those cables that were severed in the Baltic Sea over the last few months, 3 cables in all, were done by Russia in collusion with China. And that may have been a trial run for the kind of thing that they're thinking of doing and actually doing with Taiwan, that is severing all the undersea communications cables and leaving Taiwan unable to communicate with the rest of the world in the event of a crisis, which I think is coming.
Last week, the Biden administration said that it was considering a new rule that would ban or restrict Chinese drones in the United States out of national security concerns. The mysterious drones over New Jersey and across the country, Steve, are still largely unexplained. And I guess with those recent terror attacks in New Orleans and the firestorm in California, the story's gone away. Why didn't the Biden administration just issue an executive order or similar enforcement to protect the nation? Do you believe those drones we're seeing or saw are of Chinese origin?
Well, I think the information we have on this is sketchy and deliberately so. I think the American government should come clean about what it knows about those drones. And there are two possibilities. Are they ours or are they theirs? Now, the fact that the Washington, D.C. establishment has not been willing to tell us anything gives rise to all kinds of speculation. We had Congressman Jeff Van Drew of New Jersey saying there's an Iranian mothership, drone mothership, off the coast of New Jersey, which is sending these drones over. We also had intelligence officials telling Tucker Carlson that these drones were Chinese and they were being controlled by a satellite, which has since been blasted out of the sky. Now, I believe that these drones, quite frankly, Raymond, are probably ours. We know we have a hurry catch-up program to try to catch up with China and drone technology. They're way ahead of us in drone technology, and we ought to be skeptical of having any Chinese drones come here if they're manufactured in China, because they always contain backdoors in the electronics that can enable the drones, control of the drones, to be seized in the event of a conflict and used perhaps for terrorist attacks. But I know that we've been testing drones over Langley Air Force Base, and that was reported last year. I know that there was a testing corridor in New Jersey. So I kind of think just everyone should relax, because these are probably ours. But we shouldn't relax in the sense that most of the drones that are now flying in the United States are made in China. And that is a danger to all of us.
Stephen, a recent Ex Post, you shared that China probably has the ability to shut down the Panama Canal in the event of a conflict with the U.S. Now, earlier this week, President-elect Trump declined to rule out involving the U.S. military to take control of the Panama Canal.
The Panama Canal was built for our military. I'm not going to commit to that now. It might be that you'll have to do something. Look, the Panama Canal is vital to our country. It's being operated by China. China. And we gave the Panama Canal to Panama. We didn't give it to China. And they've abused it. They've abused that gift. It should have never been made, by the way.
Steve, your thoughts on this. And when did China obtain a de facto monopoly over the porting industry there in the Panama Canal or around the Panama Canal?
Well, the contract with Hutchinson Whampoa, which is a Hong Kong company, was signed in 1996, a year before the communist takeover of Hong Kong. And so nominally, that was a private company. It controls both the entry and egress, both ends of the Panama Canal. The ports are controlled now by China. And any company in Hong Kong, as you know, as is the case with any company in China, is actually de facto controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. There's no question about this. Now, we have two treaties with Panama, and one of which says in 1972 says we're responsible for the ongoing security of the canal. That treaty is still in force. So if we are concerned about the security of the canal, the ability to move our ships from the First Fleet in the Atlantic to the Pacific Fleet in the event of a conflict, we can maintain the security of the canal and remove the Chinese presence under that treaty.
Steve, I've got 2 minutes. I want to ask you about Jimmy Lai. Jimmy Lai's trial began on December 18th in 2023. It is continuing. He's been in prison for 4 years, 4.5 years. His persecution at the hands of this totalitarian regime in China really mirrors the ongoing destruction of Hong Kong itself. What do we know about his current state and the state of his trial?
Well, his current physical health is not good. He's kept in a very tiny cell. He's only allowed out for 40 minutes of exercise in a tiny wired enclosure with no contact with anyone else. He's taken in shackles to these court sessions. And for the first year, he had to sit through a year's worth of charges made by Communist Party lawyers against him, mostly false, of course. He was finally allowed to speak a few days ago, and he said, you know, I was just defending freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of assembly, which are guaranteed in the Hong Kong Basic Law. That won't be an effective defense for him because Hong Kong is no longer under the rule of law. It is under the rule of the Chinese Communist Party, and they have decided to make an example out of Jimmy Lai, who is, I believe, the number one right now communist martyr in China. He's a Catholic. He converted to Catholicism in 1997 at the time of the Chinese communist takeover of Hong Kong, because his wife says, and his wife is a faithful Catholic, that he knew he needed strength from beyond. He needed strength from a higher power. And he spends his days in solitary confinement, 4 years in solitary confinement. That's torture in itself, reading inspirational works, drawing pictures of our Lord on the cross. He's undergoing his own Via Dolorosa right now. He's at peace, though, he tells the world, and he fully expects to die in prison.
It's awful. Well, pray for Jimmy Lai. He's a great hero of the faith and a man. This agreement, the Vatican-China agreement, Steve, will now be in effect until 2028. And given what we just reported about Jimmy Lai, the current Hong Kong bishop, Cardinal Stephen Chow, recently called for more dialogue with China on this matter, this sinicization idea. Chow's predecessor, Cardinal Zen, who turned 93 this week, God bless him, would never have called for a dialogue like this. Your thoughts on what's happening there and the perversion of scripture and liturgy to accommodate this absurd Vatican-China pact?
Yeah, and of course, if you listen to Cardinal Parolin, the Cardinal Secretary of State, he will say it's just a work in progress, that we're still in dialogue. And I think they hope that by demonstrating good faith and goodwill towards the Chinese Communist Party, that the Communist Party will reciprocate. I think that is a faint hope at best. The Chinese Communist Party, underneath all of its ideological pretensions and its economic claims, there lurks a hatred of God. And they believe, the Communist Party leaders believe, that they cannot coexist with God and the followers of God. That's why the church will always be persecuted in China, in good times and bad. And that's why we need to pray for our suffering Catholics in China itself.
Amen. Stephen Mosier, we will leave it there. The Devil and Communist China, From Mao Down to Xi by Stephen Mosier, is still available at bookstores everywhere. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. We'll see you next time. Bye now. We'll be right back.